So good to be back with you for another GoldSeek.com Radio Gold Nugget segment. Today's special guest, Charles Nenner from Nenner Research Institute. Former Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke was recently declined his refinancing request on his home. And I think this kind of illustrates just how difficult the credit situation is, you know, when former professor and Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke is even having trouble with his mortgage. So it's a pleasure to have Charles Nenner back on the show today, head of Nenner Research with David Gurwitz, former Goldman Sachs technical analyst. Welcome back, Charles Nenner.
Nice to be back.
I wonder if we could start today with this tale of two economies. On one hand, we have a stock market that's near all-time record highs, at least the Dow Jones and the S&P 500, but different side to the story where millions of folks are struggling with a difficult employment situation. Sure, unemployment may be low, but actual solid jobs seem to be scarce.
First of all, I agree with you that the number doesn't reflect everything that's going on. It is true that in most circumstances, especially when we come out of a recession, then the unemployment is high and the stock market takes off again. In this case, we have a problem because we never got really to a high GDP. We got just to 3%. And the economic cycles, there are economic cycles called Euler cycles and Kitchen cycles and some more, are about to turn down. So actually, we're turning down in the economy, and that is not good news for the people who are looking for jobs. But as long as the Fed was very nice and giving out a lot of money, then as the market went up. Now, we went out of the market when it was above 2,000 because there was a price target. And I've been saying that for the next couple of years, I don't see the market appreciate more than 5% for the next couple of years. So there's not much to do. On the other side, I think the market's coming down. And I warned everybody that the biggest down move will be from 2018 to 2020. So the market is going to catch up with the weak economy.
This runs counter to the prevailing mindset. There's definitely signs of accumulation in virtually every major stock that you can see across the board. I'm sure you know the Russell Index, is, which I think is one of the best reflections of the broadest measures, is also toppy, as Peter Schiff pointed out here. And, you know, because we've had quite a run here over the last 5 or 6 years since those 2009 credit crisis lows. Do you see another financial fiasco on the horizon?
Well, the definition of fiasco is a bit difficult. You know, maybe if you saw some of my TV shows that a couple of years ago I predicted that starting 2013-14 which would start a major war cycle, that could really be very detrimental because we're really not doing so well in the economy. But if you take the normal economic cycles, then we had an up move and it's about to top. So in a normal situation, it's already normal that the economy will become weaker now when we go back into recession. The problem is that we start from such a low GDP, so we can really get even in a depression because we didn't really make it in this upswing.
And so when you talk about a war cycle, a cursory look at the nuances, that something as specific as a major global conflict might have a quantitative impetus behind it. Could you tell us more?
Well, it's interesting. As you know, that most of my work is based on cycles, and I say that it's a repetition of the past. And I did work going back to 3,000 years in the Mandarin Empire of China, spotting all the big wars. And then you come to difficult war cycles. But for the listeners, it will be interesting to check it out themselves. And there's a very clear war cycle that every time in the second decade of a century, so that's where we are now, there is a big war. So there should be a big war now. And if you go 100 years back, then there's a big war, which was the First World War, which was ending in the Second World War. And if you go back 100 years before that, you had a big war in the United States and the big war of Napoleon. And if you Google and you take every century and you say, I'm looking for a big war around the year 1500, 1400, 1300, the interesting thing is every time in a new century, in the second decade, there is a major war. Now, don't ask me to explain that because I can't. I'm just saying that then you found one war cycle that is 100 years long, but there are much more war cycles. But it's just amazing to see it that on, like clockwork, every second decade of the century, there is a new war.
I think it's quite a remarkable find. It seems to me to be worthy at least of a peer-reviewed journal article, at the very least.
By the way, you have the same thing with epidemics. You know, we're now in an epidemic of a 50-year cycle. So the big epidemic before was in the 60s, and the one before was around 1914, where they said that more people died in the epidemic than in the World War. And then was one in the half of the century. And if you go back, it's very clear now if it's because viruses mutate every 50 years or whatever it is. It's just important to know that you can expect every 50, 55 years a new big epidemic.
And that's also interesting because they're showing in Harvard now that it's mutating about 1,000 times per week under research conditions. And this is just my personal speculation. We have growth cycles in the demographics, so big bursts of population growth, that nutrition plays a huge factor in epidemics. So, for instance, in Africa, very large incidence of scurvy because, you know, we don't produce our own vitamin C, one of only three mammals, which makes Ebola much more virulent. Back on point, did you care to speculate, since, you know, we're on radio here, we have time for your innermost thoughts. Do you suspect that this is contrived by the powers that be, or is it merely just a rhythm within nature?
I think it's a rhythm in nature. That's why how we also calculate the stock market. The whole situation is, I used to be a professor in finance, and I said to the students, if you don't get it, it's because you don't want to accept that things don't move at random. You think they move at random, and then there's nothing to know in the future, or they don't move at random. Now, the interesting thing is when I was at Goldman Sachs, I was giving classes to the newcomers, and they all came from Harvard, very clever people. So they used to say, what if this and this happens? I said, listen, we give you a lot of money because we hope that based on what you learned, you can project the future. If you think there's no connection, then we don't really need you. So immediately they changed their mind based on the fact that everything is based on the test, and if that's not correct, then you can never predict anything.
My current dissertation is based on the fact that the EMH, the efficient market hypothesis, has a couple little flaws in there, and one of them is this random factor that you refer to that really opens up a wealth of opportunity for the astute investor.
Right, but it saves the people who make a lot of money and have no knowledge, or say, listen, nobody could have known that this is going to happen, so don't blame me.
Right. It's an interesting umbrella of protection for those who are earning millions of dollars for just managing other people's money. Well said. Well, let's talk a little bit about China. You know, this is an important engine. From what I heard recently, they are either close to or have just eclipsed the United States as the world's largest economy. This is a fascinating story in and of itself, given that, you know, just a few years ago, I remember when China was in third place. So we have an enormously important component of the global economy. Unfortunately, they've been slowing, growing at the slowest annual pace in about 5 years, industrial production slightly off. One wonders how this might impact the markets. Are you watching this at all?
Yeah, well, first of all, let's just establish that if you look in history, that around 1900, you know who was the second biggest economy in the world? China. Yeah, and then they fell back. So they had to have a lot of starts. Now, China has what's called Taoism, and they don't have yet the Western capitalist idea. So it's always a wait and see if they will create an internal market. If I can just explain it with a small story, there was a man, a very rich man, who had some boat problems, and he came into an island, and he saw that the people had no work. He says, well, if I would start something over here, I will have very cheap labor. So he came back, and he built all kinds of institutions, and he had very cheap labor. The only problem was that after 3-4 months, the people had enough money for what they needed, so they didn't come back to work. So he asked his friend, what I'm going to do now? He says, now you're going to import all the flyers from Saks Avenue or whatever, so they know what there is in the world in order to create the appetite for what they need. Or actually, they don't need it, but what there is to buy. So suddenly they saw all these things that they don't need, but they want to have it, so they went back to work. So one problem in the East is that, or it's not a problem, it's just their philosophy that they're still in a situation that they don't have this need that was created by 100 years of capitalism in the West. And we still have to wait how it develops.
So you are on the fence with regard to China.
Well, I don't think China's going to, I think they go down to 2.5% GDP. My problem is, as I've always been saying, is the deflation in the world. Europe is almost in deflation. China, as crazy as it sounds, all the inflation is going away. They're not going to help. A strong dollar will create deflation in the United States, and I think we're in for a big problem with deflation. As is, most economists don't really know how to deal with deflation because they best remember what happened in their lifetime. I think that the Fed is going to make major mistakes and we're going to get in trouble.
We're already headed on that path. You'll recall that our former Fed predecessor, Dr. Bernanke, he cut his teeth, you might say, in academia with regard to dealing with what was called deflation at the time during the Great Depression. And now they've certainly cut off that lifeline that had been thrown to the domestic economy. Do you expect that the Fed at some point will have to reverse course on the closure of QE and open up the spigots and allow liquidity to pour back into the markets?
Well, first of all, I think it's not going to help anymore. But Europeans, they say it's too little, too late if they do it. And if they do it, then we're really going to get in trouble because the markets will understand that there's almost nothing more they can do after they do that. So they have no leeway of trying to save the economy, and that's a very bad sign.
So let's talk about the implications of all of this on the general markets. You all certainly cover the entire spectrum of markets, as David Gerwitz showed here on the show. He walked through the report. It's very comprehensive, thorough, but our listener base is primarily concerned with commodities and in particular gold and silver and related equities. Do you have any comments for them? We've had a really brutal 3 years here. If you're looking for more deflation, that would sound ominous for the precious metals.
We're in the middle of a bear market in commodities. There is this thing, geopolitical, I think things are going to happen, and that's probably why silver and gold are an exception. We had major cycles that were bottoming starting in the summer, and really it's holding up since the summer. So now we're playing every short-term cycle low until the cycle top, and then we go out again, because I still think that this gold market will go to 2100. It just has a very low start. So comes up the question, why in deflation would gold up? And then I advise people who are students of gold and silver and commodities to see that most bull markets in gold were in deflationary, not inflationary. If you have deflation, then the companies are doing very badly, because people postpone what they want to buy because next week is going to be cheaper. You can get a financial crisis like what you had in Greece and in Europe. So even interest rates can go up because it's very hard to get the money, to get a loan. And real estate is also not doing well. So since the money is very cheap, people will run into gold because at least they have something and they don't know where to put their money. So that's the reason for deflationary bull market in gold. The interesting point is from 1800 till 1970, we were around the zero point in inflation, deflation, except two times when there was a war, there was a spike of 9%, but on the average, it was close to deflation. And still, we had nice moves in gold. They should not think that gold is only a hedge against inflation, also against deflation. And especially if we get in trouble in the world, if epidemics come, who knows what's going to happen, and maybe people in big quantities want to move their home place, what they take is they take gold with them or silver with them. So that's an exceptional thing. But if you look at the grains and other things, they're really in a bear market for a while to go.
How would you respond to comments, you know, from academia, the paper by Summers, real returns, negative real returns, and to a lesser degree, negative real interest rates are a vital component of gold bull markets?
Yeah, I agree with that. That's just what I had tried to explain. But we had very low inflation, 1800 up to 1970, when they start fooling around with the gold standard. But still, gold had nice spikes.
You have nowhere else to go, right?
No, you have nowhere to go.
Well, let's talk then about what type of contingency plans investors should be making. It would seem to me that given the scenario you've outlined here today, that, you know, we have limited downside risk, at least from your perspective, for gold and silver, whereas the upside would certainly seem, the risk to reward, it looks very favorable. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I agree with that.
So are the miners presenting any interesting opportunities? It's really been a ransacked industry.
You would say that. You would say now it's a time to buy the miners. The only reason why you would buy them is because while you're waiting for the gold market to move up, you get some dividend. But it doesn't look, I just looked at it, it doesn't look the miners going to do much better than gold itself. So there's no reason to buy the miners except that you will get, I don't know what you get, 2.5% dividend. At least it's something while you're waiting. That I'm not so afraid of all these stories about higher interest rates, not on the short side and not on the long side. I think for the moment, also the yields on the 30-year will not go up. Another interesting thing is that the dollar is stronger, but starting next year, I expect it to go into a bear market. I expect people to realize that the health of the United States economy with all the debt they have is not as good as they think. Now they close their eyes for it. And that will be very bad for the dollar.
Well, sure. Well, there's also, you know, the general equities markets. We have a growing group of folks here interested in the Dow, the S&P, and their portfolios. Still investors today, about 50% of the typical portfolio comprised of equities and stocks. Of course, there's the bond market as well. Do you think that maybe it's time to start locking in profits or at least looking at alternatives to U.S. equities?
The problem is, you know, the pension funds have that, especially in Europe, and the people also have that. Even, you know, when they're not retired, when they think about retirement, they have to get some income, and where are they going to get the income from? And that's simply not there. So the only thing they can do is it can take risks that in a normal situation they wouldn't take. So if you ask me, what you do is in deflation when it's coming, you go into cash, but then you don't have any income. But at least you save your money. You don't lose it by doing the wrong investment.
We saw at least a mini episode of deflation in 2008, 2009. And to say it was cataclysmic to the markets, I think, is an understatement. What's interesting to me today is how people's minds seem to have moved past it as though the event was just an anomaly. But for those of us that monitor the markets day by day, I think it represented a sea change event that requires perhaps a whole new epistemology regarding how we plan for the future. In other words, I think you might agree that without the coordinated efforts of global central bankers, and in particular the United States and the ECB, there would not have been any markets after 2009 that I'm aware of.
I remember CNBC sitting in 2007 talking about deflation, and they looked like you must be coming from a different planet. And I said, listen, I don't mind being wrong. What I'm afraid of is that I'm the only voice that used the words deflation. How can that be? And I just want to tell you, when I was at Goldman Sachs, they did a research of how people made careers and how they made a better career. And they definitely showed that people who are positive in their thinking made a much better career than people who are not positive in their thinking. So the whole world wants to think positive, because if you think negative, they don't. I give you one example. I told my brokers 2 months ago, this market's going down. Now let me just give one indicator. The only time that they didn't want to have me on television was in 1987. Of course, the Tesla's going to crash. And now I said the same thing. We're going to have a correction, but nobody wants to hear it. So they don't invite you. You don't hear the reality. You only hear the positive thing, because the viewers want to hear positive things. If it's all the time negative, then people close the television. So they don't really get reality.
An ounce of prevention is certainly worth 1 million pounds of cure. So why don't we then talk about How the typical investor can take this information and use it to better plan for their retirement, their portfolios? Because, you know, as you say, we are facing a conundrum here, aren't we? As folks move towards retirement, as you say, they're on fixed incomes. And this is already a challenging world with everyday goods and services prices increasing. This leaves the typical investor in a quandary. So if, as you say, we're facing deflation, but we need income, would you suggest that people keep a portion of their funds and higher yielding instruments, or is that a potential risk as well?
That's also a risk. Junk bonds are a risk, and companies can cut their dividend. It is a situation where you really have to be on top. So it really would help if they would take a look at our website where we explain how everything is functioning, Charles Lindner Research Center. And you have to be a little bit more active than the world wanted. They really wanted to put you to sleep. Everything is long term, but in the long term, you see it doesn't work. So you have to study a little bit. We can help with the timing, but it is something that you have to be on top.
Certainly recommend that all of our listeners today navigate their web browsers to the Charles Nenner Research website. Links at our webpage. Charles Nenner, closing comments you'd like to share with the listeners as we wind down the discussion?
Yes, write down what I said is that you have a major crash between 2018 and 2020. By the time already you forgot what I said, but all the big guys wrote it down and they're all ready for that crash. And the other thing is, believe me, when I said it, now it's a little bit lower. I said it when it was about 2015, the market will not see more than 5% appreciation. So you have to make a choice if 5% is the top for the next couple of years. But there's a lot of downside to what you really want to do.
To me, it sounds exactly what I'm seeing technically. Take a look at just individual companies, everything really solid companies. They've reached parabolic, in many cases, levels, things you would have expected, I don't know, circa 1929, you know, 87, 2000.com bubble-like conditions. And this is a little more frightening than 2007.
Well, I tell you, the point is the margin outstanding, so that actually speculation is higher than 2007. The price to book value and the price to sales is not as good as 2007, although we're higher. And underlying, if you do fundamental research, you see the market doesn't look as good as it is. On top of that, the price earnings is already on the high side. So people have to make good argument why they want to be in stocks. Well, usually the argument is there's nothing else to do. But that's not a scientific argument. That's asking for trouble.
Charles Nenner, folks at Goldman Sachs would give their eye teeth, I'll bet, to have you back. I hope our listeners today recognize what an opportunity this is.
You get it for a reasonable time for free because it proves itself. And after a while, then you can maybe get a phone call that you think were correct. Would you like it? And if not, that's also good. But at least you have the advantage of for a month or so, 2 months, I don't remember, really to get an insight how we do it.
Well, if you want to know what's going to happen in the market 6, 12, 18, and 24 months ahead of time, the consistent track record here says get a copy of this report. Charles Nenner, we're going to look forward to having you back on GoldSeek.com radio. We appreciate you taking time for us today from your busy schedule, and we wish you continued success, sir.
I wish you too, and let's stay in touch because a lot of things are going to happen.
Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant cave KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.